I also strongly believe that management is something one does to improve one's life, the lives of those around you, as well as the lives of all the people your small or large organization touches. At least that's what I believe the purpose of management is. Many would disagree with me. And therein lies the reason for everything that I'm sharing with you today. That is to create a manager's version of the Hippocratic Oath, to provide managers, wherever one finds them, with a baseline of understanding disconnected from their job, from the company within which they find themselves. Now, that's almost heresy. I can just imagine companies hiring me to come in and talk about management in that context, disconnected from the company within which you find yourself, to establish a universal standard against which all managers worthy of the name hold themselves personally, whatever their company's standard is. And by so doing, raise the level of performance of all organizations, small and large, worldwide. And I believe that's not only possible, I believe it's absolutely probable, provided one approaches it in a thoughtful way, in a mindful way, with right thinking. A word of caution about that. While this seminar is intended to serve as a practical manual and guide for anyone who has to manage anything, it was not my intention in doing this to provide you with an action plan for doing the job called management. No, this isn't an owner's manual. What I have attempted to do here instead is what I believe to be the essential job of this meeting and the book that will follow. And it's to identify the cardinal characteristics of the enlightened manager, the few worthy and steadfast rules I've been able to conjure up over the years from the confusing welter of conflicting demands every one of us has faced every day, and finally, a clear overall picture of what every manager's true accountabilities are, how they're best played out, no matter the job, the specifics of your people, the mission of the organization in which you find yourself, the objectives of which you've been forced to be measured, no matter how enlightened or unenlightened these objectives might be. I've drawn another important conclusion from all of the work my organization, the E-Myth Academy, and I have done over the years with both small businesses and large. And that is that no manager can manage a large business effectively. The larger the company, the more insane, the more inhuman the expectations of the managers become. Working as a manager in a huge organization is doomed to be a Kafkaesque experience, deadening to the soul, deflating to the spirit, demoralizing to the essence of any right-thinking person. Any right-thinking person who enters the world of big business will, in short order, become by the very necessity of the job what I believe to be a wrong-thinking person. Values disappear, balance is out of the question, do it, do it, do it become the marching orders of the day, cut and slash, slash and burn become the mindset of all, trying to salvage what little respect and dignity they can by becoming invisible. Just do it is the rage. Just do it. Our lives that are at stake here. The shareholders are watching. Oh, my God, the shareholders. That anonymous capitalist pool of unrest swimming about in its own mortal terror of losing its gains, gains made by betting on a hopefully sure thing, only to find that it isn't. Our shares, the focus of big business, which is then called value, which has nothing to do with value. Let the shareholders come in and work here for a few weeks. Let's see what happens to our value then. No, management in large organizations must change the nature of large organizations. Oh, I'm sure there are exceptions to the picture I painted here, but I have never found one. No, the only effective management model I would ascribe to would be that of the small business. And so this meeting is about managing a small enterprise. It's my strongly held conviction that for large organizations to thrive, they must rapidly find ways to become small organizations. That's not to say that I agree with re-engineering, downsizing, right-sizing, the phenomena which rages all around us. None of the above initiatives have been engaged in with the spirit I speak of in this meeting. No, rather than re-engineering, rather than cutting free huge swaths of people from the jobs they've grown to depend on, the large organization should instead find ways within the restructuring of the business to utilize people to make the transition from large to small so that all are served in the process. People should be redeployed, not re-engineered. The capital invested in such redeployment would be the best investment large organizations could make, not only for the large organization, its people, its management, its shareholders, but for the community, the state, the county within which they have come to life. Imagine a company peopled by true believers, people who live for the mission rather than the mission statement. Imagine organizations which lived and breathed such a mission to create more life. That's where redeployment would mean. Let's get small would be the rallying cry. Let's break up into worthy small enterprises, entrepreneurially led enterprises, business units that are small enough so that one can truly have an impact upon and be impacted by the people you come into contact with every day. Small enterprises, which when they reached a certain definable size, let's say 100 people, would then themselves spin off another business, and it another, and then yet another, creating electricity, vitality, passion, integrity, operating systems, management focus, rather than the feeling of bloat, greed, and denial and fear which runs amok in every large organization worldwide. Show me one that's different. I don't believe you can. Then this meeting is about how a manager would comport himself or herself within such an entrepreneurially driven enterprise. How a manager today could regain his or her dignity, reestablish his or her integrity, become a model of right-minded thinking and enlightened work. As I said, I call such a manager an E-Myth manager. Literally translated, the E-Myth stands for the entrepreneurial myth. The fact that most small businesses are begun not by entrepreneurs, as commonly thought, but by technicians suffering from an entrepreneurial seizure. It's the complete lack of entrepreneurial perspective in most small businesses and large which kills them. Rather than starting a business of one's own to grow so that it operates apart from the owner, most small business owners do exactly the opposite. They create a job for themselves. Interestingly, most managers do the same. Over the years at the E-Myth Academy, our mission has been to transform this condition wherever we find it, to assist small business owners in the often complex but hugely rewarding process of reinventing their business into an entrepreneurial hotbed of forward-moving energy, productivity, invention, from the tyranny of routine that normally exists within most small businesses. It's been over these past two decades that the term E-Myth has become a verb rather than a noun. To E-Myth their business meant to create an exciting, productive, independently operating enterprise out of a struggling, ineffective, unrewarding, life-tapping drudge, which most small businesses turn out to be, not only for their owners, but for the people who work in them. It's the evolution of the E-Myth from that of a book title to a way of reinventing and managing an extraordinarily entrepreneurial enterprise that the E-Myth has become a model for success, in my mind, in any small business. Therefore, the name, the E-Myth Manager. So let's get on with the seven steps of a business development program and a management development program and the transformation of an existing business into an enterprise and that enterprise into a stunningly original way to do business in any world, in any market, with any people. Let's take the first step. The first step is understanding that there are three components of what we have now come to call an enterprise. An enterprise is not a business. An enterprise includes the business. An enterprise is, in effect, what an entrepreneur is there to create. Ray Kroc, the founder of McDonald's, was envisioning an enterprise, not a business. Fred Smith of Federal Express was envisioning an enterprise, not a business. The point of an enterprise is to do something in the world that isn't being done as effectively or at all by any other enterprise. So by the very nature of the entrepreneurial dictum, the entrepreneur is inventing something that does not exist. The entrepreneur is the inventor of a business that does something that is not being done by anyone else in the world. Now, you might say then, but Michael, doesn't that make it very, very difficult for me to start an ordinary business? No. The extraordinary thing about an enterprise that does something that's not being done or not being done as well in the world is that most things are being done badly everywhere you look. And so it's not necessary for an entrepreneur to invent some absolutely incredibly difficult thing to create. What is absolutely clear is that the entrepreneur's role in life is to invent out of an ordinary business one that does ordinary things in an extraordinary way. So our role in the entrepreneurial business is to discover the way, I call it the E-Myth way, to produce extraordinary results with ordinary people doing ordinary things in an extraordinary way. There is no other explanation for Federal Express than just that. There's no other explanation for Disney World than just that. If you take Disney World apart and look at all of the parts of Disney World, you would see ordinary things being done in an extraordinary way because the business is driven by a vision. So the clarity of vision of the end product of our business is the entrepreneur's role. And what most of us do is to abdicate that role because we do not see ourselves as visionaries. A visionary is simply a person who has a picture in his or her head of an end result. Whether that picture is a grand picture or a less grand picture or even an ordinary picture, all of us are visionaries. The problem is you don't think of yourselves that way. You have a picture in your head of what's going to happen tonight when you reach in the refrigerator and get that beer. You have a picture in your head of all manner and sorts of things, mainly which don't serve you. And so effectively understand we as human beings live with pictures in our heads. The true question is, how to learn to create extraordinary pictures that effectively can be manifested in the world in the form of a business, entrepreneurial pictures. What is the process for doing that? There is a distinct process for doing that. It's a process every single person in the room can learn, provided you have the desire. So effectively, the reason I know I can't manage people is because I cannot give people desire. I can artificially excite them, but I can't give you desire. The only way you can get desire is by yourself. The only way I can touch into that desire, or let me say discover that desire, is by painting a picture of what my desire is in such an eloquent way that you can clearly determine whether it matches a natural desire in you or not. And as we get to the people development process here, you'll see why that's so critical. The clarity of the entrepreneur's vision is told in the form of a story. Let me tell you the story of my business. Let me tell you the story of my business. The story of your business is not the story of what's transpired to date. The story of your business is what the business is going to look like when it's finally done. The story of your business is what the business is going to look like when it's finally done. Fred Smith has told his story. Day after day after day after day, it's the same story, and it goes on and it goes on and it goes on, and it lives in him and it breathes in him. Debbie Fields of Mrs. Fields Cookies can tell you her story. It's the same story. You can smell it. You can feel it. You can taste it. You can touch it. You can see it. You can experience it. Every part of you and become connected to Debbie Field's story because it's so alive in her. And the story goes on, and the story goes on, and the story goes on. You got to ask yourself this question. Understand this very entrepreneurial question. What is my story? And ladies and gentlemen, let me tell you, the manager without a story is dead. And the story can't simply be the regurgitation of rhetoric in the form of a mission statement, which is dead. The story has to be alive. It has to have purpose. It has to have meaning. It has to have drive. It's got to compel people, touch people, reach into people. It's got to be real. And it's got to be something you practice every single day. Without that, it's flat. Without that, it's meaningless. And most people who are asked about the work they do, let me tell you what they say. I get no meaning in what I do. Everybody is searching for meaning, more so today than ever before. Because somehow, the whole idea of the superhighway, of technology, of the glut of information, the fact of the internet, all of the distractions that are available to us now, by distraction, the attraction by distraction is effectively where we all are now, looking for more, looking for more, looking for more, looking for more. Now I can plug into any place and touch people I don't even know and read stuff I don't even care about, and I can do that 24 hours a day. My God, it's incredible. I can really go to sleep. Think about it. The attraction of distraction, the glut of meaningless data to satisfy the unsatisfiable, the insatiable need to be alive. Fill in the void. Why do you think people eat? Fill in the void, fill in the void. Far beyond I need food, far beyond what I'm truly in search of, fill in the void, fill in that hole inside of myself, which can't be filled. So effectively, just to create platitudes in a business, in the form of a story, as a marketing strategy, or a sales tool, ladies and gentlemen, is exactly the opposite of what I'm talking about. We all know about those things. We all know about the latest mission statement. We all know about the latest ploy is to manipulate consumers in order to believe that we really feel or care about anything. We all know about all those things because they're all around us. Advertising is all around us. We're confused with ads every single day. 10,000 messages being communicated to you every single day, every single minute. Here it comes, here it comes, here it comes, to the point where you go to sleep. Now it's really got to touch you. How's it going to touch you now? Well, it really better get bright. Have you seen what's happening with technology? Its ability to absolutely inundate you with sound, inundate you with color, inundate you with action. The way things are edited today in our most popular movies, have you watched it? Have you sat in the theater when the sound comes on, boom, bam, bam, blast? You see the kids around you, they're not even affected by it. What am I talking about? I'm talking about this must be real. And it must add real value. And if you're coming from a center of gravity, which is called an ethical center, the real value must be real value, and you must be able to demonstrate it. Because if what you're selling, if what your business is about, is not providing real value, demonstrated ethically, then effectively what I'm saying is the manager is not serving himself or herself in a truly life-impassioned way. Now, that might sound more than anybody's prepared to do. So be it. I'm saying it's not for everyone. But I'm saying it better be. Because effectively, the less it is what we do and who we are, the more distracted will become. And John Moses is not an aberration. John Moses is a way of life. John Moses is the story of countless millions of people who bought into the corporate exercise and left themselves behind. As the lady said, I'm giving up emotional ground day after day after day. And the problem is there's so little left. So having said that, now realizing that, in fact, an enterprise is just that. Three levels of this organization, this commercial organization. And those three levels are the enterprise at the entrepreneurial level, the business at the manager's level, and the practice at the technician's level. And the enterprise provides the vision, and the business provides the process, and the practice does the work to produce in concert the result that that business's vision is designed to create. And what result is that? So ask yourself this question again. What is the result my business is there to produce? What is the single result my business is designed to produce? And how does that differentiate my business from everyone else's business in the world? Difficult question? Tough question. But tell me, what other question makes more sense? None.
When you think about your life, what is it that first strikes you? How does one even begin to contemplate the span of one's life? How does one relate to it? Listen, this is very important to the two of us. My life, your life, has no aim. Not if we're honest, it doesn't. Our lives are the object of a series of events which in themselves are aimless, one moment after another. And yet, as much as I would like to believe I am present in each and every one of these moments, I have to admit I'm not. I'm not here now. You aren't either. You and I are there now, and then there now, and then there now, either in the past or in the future, either in our imagination or in our memory, either in this thought or in that thought, in a thought about being alive. And yet, of course, we are alive. But if I'm not here, if I'm either in the past or in the future, what is the past and what is the future but a score written out of my imagination? Do you see what I'm saying? Do you understand how important this is to you and to me? Do you see that if you can't relate the past and the future to each other as a series of present moments which are experienced fully in the present, not as an idea of the present, but as an actual factual present, then there is no present. Then the present is simply an intoxicating stream of non-truths, of non-experiences, of memories and imaginations, of a connection of barely realizable dots, which will, in their unreasonable associations, connect with each other as they will, without any part of you or me truly participating, except as we do now, dreaming. And so this is why I say that one must make an effort, an intense effort, to invent a primary aim, an object of one's intention. Ironically, one must make an object of one's life in order to become the subject of one's life. One must go to work on one's life rather than to simply go to work in one's life. But how do we do that? How do I make an object of my life while becoming the subject of my life, given the ordinary way I am approached by my life? Yes, it's true. Even as I say it, I know unquestionably that it is true. I am approached by my life. I don't approach it. I am approached by my life. I wasn't prepared for it. I didn't invent it. I was inserted somehow into this stream of living and then surprised by everything I encountered in it. My mother, my father, my sisters, my brother, my education, my childhood, the people with whom I came into contact, the schoolyard, my bicycle, the streets I rode as a boy, the trees by the side of the streets, the surprises which were my relatives, my aunts, my uncles, my cousins. all of the strangers who came up to me, my girlfriends, those very sexy creatures who astonished me, my travels from here to there, my first car, my saxophone, all those trips from my home to my music lessons, this endless stream of sensations, of catastrophes, of surprises, of astonishments, of fears, of obsessions, of obligations, of terror, of failure, of success, of all those things that went on and still go on, even now at the astonishing age of 60. Don't you see how little of it was planned by me? Don't you see how much of this is simply moved of its very own accord, of the forces which you and I don't possibly understand? That is why I say that your primary aim, your purpose, your vision, your selective direction, your wished-for conclusion, your mission, your intention, your will, your wish, your wanting, your need to be more, much more than an accident moved by the incidence of the events of those things which simply showed up at your door, is so darned important. I don't know how to say it any more emphatically, but I do know that without an emphasis, without a passion for direction, without a need for understanding, without a wanting so big and so full that it compels you to long for more than this, this absence, this negation, this denial, this empty flat series of sensations, there is a tragedy brewing, a tragedy which will ultimately end with the soul-surprising shock of not having been here at all, of having blown the whole thing, of having completely missed the cosmic opportunity that God gave each and every one of us to experience. Think of it, to have been here and not to have been here at all. So the all-consuming question comes down to, what do you want? I couldn't ask you anything more important than this. I'm a guy who's done more than most people would ever fantasize doing, who has earned and lost more money than most of you could ever dream about, who has had more experiences in my accidentally charmed life than most people would ever dream about having. I'm the charmed hero fame talks about. I've got what you want, and it's not anything you could possibly imagine it to be. I'm saying to you that I've persisted where everyone else quit. I've pursued the elusive where everyone else gave up, and I did it after most people thought I had already failed. I did it in spite of what everyone else believed I could and would do. And now, when so many like to think me a hero, I tell them with no uncertainty that I'm not. I'm simply a guy in process, and most of the time I'm off center, out of kilter, on a tangent, off on a tear, losing ground rather than gaining ground, completely out to lunch. You know what I'm telling you, don't you? That you can't put it off any longer. You can't put your destiny off any longer. Every minute you allow the moron in you to take control, the fat guy to pick your food, the sleeping dolt to determine your day, as I have over and over and over and over again, and as you have too, every time you give in to the deadening side of yourself, you lose irreplaceable ground. It's gone forever. It will never be regained. Listen, this is not a motivational tape. There's a war going on in here, in each and every one of us, and it's the only war you or I can afford to concern ourselves with. It's your own personal Bosnia. It's the war within you, and it's going on even as we speak. It's the war between the self in you who simply wants to go to sleep to avoid the pain, and the self in you who wants to know the answer to the only question worth asking, but which we always forget to ask. Who am I? Who am I? That's the question. Who is this stranger wearing this strange suit, breathing this strange air on this beautiful, stunningly beautiful planet? Who am I, and what do I want? Why am I here at all? Join me in asking this question. Join me in celebrating our lives. Join me in shaping your primary aim. Join me in beginning the quest now, in this moment, where you are, in this mystery. We have a way, all of us, of avoiding reality. And so we listen to these tapes and begin dreaming, or get motivated, or turn off at the sound of a voice, or an idea which doesn't quite fit. You know what I mean, don't you? Well, this is not the seminar. This that you're listening to right now was done at another time by the part of me which wanted to bring you to the center of the ideas I'm presenting to a live audience in the seminar, but which is very, very difficult, if not impossible to do, using the seminar medium. Now, don't misunderstand me. The live seminar has its place. There's an exciting exchange of energy that goes on in the live seminar between the audience and the speaker, between the audience and me. It's good for both of us, the speaker and the audience, this energy. There's an electricity that happens that can't be explained when things are going right, and there's an absolute deadness that takes over when things are going wrong. Sometimes it's this and sometimes it's that, and I can assure you, you never know in advance what it's going to be. But here, in the studio, as I sit reading to you right now what I've written before, there's a completely different kind of energy. This energy is intended by me to bring you to a different place, a quieter place, a more introspective place, a more reflective place than at the seminar. You might say that I planned this reading as a counterpoint to the seminar. I hope it works for you. Well, the subject here, believe it or not, is the critical importance of creating your primary aim. I want you to know that I know this is not an easy thing for you to do. For the very best of us, sitting down to create a primary aim is an unnatural act. The reason this is so is because we're so unaccustomed to making an object out of our lives. Intentionally, that is. Unintentionally, we're always making an object out of our lives. But that's at the sensory level. That's where we live in our sensations. Our sensations very readily react to things on the outside and the inside as though they were objects to be reacted to. I just smelled jasmine. Jasmine is out there in something else. I just hit my thumb with a hammer. The sensation in here is created by an object out there. Things are always happening like that. But the kind of thing I'm talking about here, literally sitting down and writing out my thoughts about what I want my primary aim to look like, what I want my life to look like when it's done, well, that's a completely different sort of thing. And I know it's awkward to most people. They feel silly doing it. And then they feel embarrassed because they don't know how to feel unembarrassed by thinking thoughts they've never thought before or never been trained to think before. Then the stupid guy in us says, duh, and then we fall asleep on the table and wake up sometime later and turn the light off and go to bed. At least that's how it's proven itself to be with most of the people I've worked with doing this thing I call business development or e-myth mastery or whatever you call it over the years. The stupid guy wakes up and says, duh, and everyone goes to sleep until they wake up under the table, wondering where they've been and what they've been doing, and then they all go back to work at what they don't feel stupid about so they can do high fives with their friends and feel in control of their lives again until one day they wake up again under the table and say, whoa, where have I been? And start looking for their primary aim worksheet so they can get something going in their lives again. And it goes on and on and on like that, doesn't it? Start to change your life and the stupid guy wakes up and puts everyone to sleep. And then if you're lucky, the smart guy wakes up under a table, not of his own choosing. And he says, what the heck? And starts to do something to change your life. And then the stupid guy wakes up and so on and so on and so on. What? Did you think this only happens to you? Did you think that you were the only one who fell asleep under the table when the important things of your life needed doing? Well, join the club. You're not. But hear me. There's only one way out of it. If you don't address it now, it'll continue of its own volition. It's the tyranny of metaphysical routine that grinds most of mankind into primordial dust. It's the soul food we feed to the moon, some wise man once said. It's the juice of our lives being eaten, and if you listen closely, you can hear the munch, munch, munch. It's what we do when we're not living. It's the vampire inside of each and every one of us sucking our blood. The vampire can't stand the light of day because the light of day is reality. The vampire sleeps during the day in a coffin of his or her own choosing and only wakes up at night when no one can see him. The vampire can't stand to be seen. Do you know what I mean? Do you see the mythology working itself out in the way we lead our lives? The vampire is dead, the walking dead. Who among us can fail to see the metaphor playing itself out in our lives as we attempt to come alive and then fail and then fail and then fail once again and then try again? So that's what I mean when I say your primary aim is your intention to create light, to create a spotlight on your future, to create a clear sighting way ahead of you on the path of your own choosing, to come awake in the day, to be seen by yourself, to select as a matter of intention the one way, the sure way, the clear way, the only way to be fully alive is to choose life in the light. is to choose a particular kind of life in the light, is to paint your unique picture on the wall where everyone can see it, and most of all, where you can see it, in the light, to claim ownership of yourself and to deny the dumb guy in the clear light of day, where everything is visible, is clear, is open to inspection, is open to redemption. And that's what this almost religious act is all about. The sanctity of life can only be experienced in the act of creation of it. Let me say that again. The sanctity of life can only be experienced in the act of creation of it. And the act of creation of your life requires an articulation of its dimensions, the form it will take, the way your body will fit into it, and the way it will fit around your body. The creation of your primary aim requires a full-blooded imagination, a visualization of the beginning of your wish to become in a place you wish to become it. Can you see it more clearly now? This is grown-up work at its hardest. This is childlike work at its easiest. This is the treehouse you envisioned as a boy. This is the hiding place you envisioned as a girl. Can you see it calling you there? Are you climbing the tree now? Can you experience the exhilaration in your limbs, knowing that as high as the tree is, it is within reach, it can be yours? Can you smell the wind? Can you feel it clutching at your body? Can you see and feel and taste all that goes on up here in the tree that doesn't go on down there? In the tree, you become someone else completely. In the tree, you have risen above the mortal coil. In the tree, you are closer to God, aren't you? Can you see what it means to evoke your appearance at the top of the tree in the world and out of the world? Well, that's what your primary aim is and can be. It is the invention of a new life, a new view of life, a new dimension in life, and apart from life. All of that, I say, is in your power. If you can only remember it when the stupid guy wakes up and goes, duh, and you turn lovingly to him inside and go, shh. It will be all right. Everything will be all right. Go to sleep. And so he does, the dear dumb thing, as you continue your way up the tree of your life, the tree of your becoming, the tree which is waiting for you, even as we speak.
The three levels of your business. Let's start as the manager, then, who's going to work for a new company. Let's start all over again. You're done with the seminar. You go home, you quit your job. So now you have quit your job. Now you say, well, I'm going to start all over again. I'm going to begin my life anew. I'm become the kind of manager Michael's talking about. When I become the kind of manager Michael's talking about, he's saying there's a process that I must go through. And that process is the process through which I'm going to evaluate the place I go to work. In other words, I'm not just going to go out and look for a job and prove to them I can do it. What I'm going to go do is to develop the ethical center, what I call the center of gravity of a company, of an entrepreneur, of a manager, of a technician. The center of gravity, which keeps me on the mat in a clearly centered way, which is, this is where I am in relationship to the world. I start from inside me to create the standards by which I value the world, as opposed to start with the world by the way I value me. I cease being object-centered and I become subject-centered. And I begin to ask the question, who am I? What do I believe? That first step in this process is called the creation of my primary aim, which is step one of the seven-step process once you've quit your job. Now, hear me. I'm not suggesting you quit your job. I'm suggesting you act as though you did. I'm suggesting that tonight when you go home, you can start the process. Because essentially, you must stop and start all over again. There is no way you can continue doing it, busy, to transform anything outside of yourself until you stop and start all over again. You have to act as though today is the first day of the rest of your life, and that everything you've done up to this point in time is lost. You have a second chance. God is the most generous gent in the world. God just gave you a second chance because you chose to take your life and completely re-engage with it in a different way than you've done up to this point in time. Now, who am I to tell you how you've engaged with your life up to this point in time? Are you awake? You with me? Okay, don't go to sleep in this one. This is the big one. We're all an accident waiting to happen. Every single one of us, an accident waiting to happen. We got married by accident. We got divorced by accident. We have kids by accident. Went to school by accident. Got into business by accident. Got the job you got by accident. If it works, you take credit for it. And if it doesn't, you blame everybody else. You know the truth. I know the truth. We're an accident waiting to happen. All we're looking for is something to happen that's going to be different than everything that did. Boy, I can't wait to get lucky. Well, let me tell you something, ladies and gentlemen. The problem with getting lucky is you have no control over it. Now, you might say, yeah, put yourself in the right place at the right time, but effectively, you don't know, have the knowledge to do that. There isn't the time to do that. So can't start out there. We got to start in here, and I'm going to tell you exactly how to do your primary aim. Now, if you've listened to my other tapes, you already heard this part, but I'm going to do it again because you can never hear it enough because you haven't done it. So let's do it in earnest this time. Okay? We're about to do your primary aim. And what that means is cut yourself off from the last life you had. It's over. You died. You're being reborn. But you got to make a choice. And this is the choice. What I want you to see is a picture. What I want you to see is a picture of a room, a beautiful room, golden drapes, golden carpets, golden upholstered chairs. Everyone you know is in that room, your friends, your relatives, your enemies. Anyone and everyone you could imagine coming to the most important occasion of your life, they're all there in that room. You died. It's your funeral. Now, just that moment, I want you to hear the sound of your voice coming from the four corners of the room. You're telling a story, and you ain't talking. It's an audio tape. It's the story of your life. You're telling everybody at your funeral the story of your life. What would you like to say? Understand, it's not the life up to now. It's the life from this moment until then. What would you like to be able to say you did in your life? What does your life look like in that tape? What did you do that you know you wish you could do? Ogden Nash once said, it's the sins of omission, not the sins of commission that kill us. It's not the things we do in our life. It's the things we don't do in our life. What are the things you wish to do, absolutely committed to do? What is it you want your life to mean? That's your primary aim. You cannot take this new job until you know what your life is to be. Because if you take this new job without this center of gravity, without this purpose, without this vision, without this picture, ladies and gentlemen, you'll be reliving the accident you created in the life before. Everything will remain the same. The light at the end of the tunnel will be a train coming this way. See, at this moment, you have a choice. And the problem is, with inside of you are all these characters who won't let you make it. Does anybody know the characters I'm talking about? Does anybody know all the characters in you who confuse you? Does anybody know that there isn't one big eye inside of you who wants something clearly, that there are a whole bunch of little eyes, each contending, and they're all contending all the time? First it's this, then it's that. It's the fat guy, it's the skinny guy, it's the big guy, it's the little guy, it's the guy that wants freedom, it's the guy that wants entrapment, it's the guy who wants to be a mother, it's the guy who wants to be a father, it's the guy who wants this, it's the guy who wants that, it's the guy who wants to be responsible, it's the guy who wants to be irresponsible, it's the guy who doesn't want to drink, it's the guy who does want to drink, and it's the guy who wants to do this, and it's the guy who wants to do that. Does anybody ever see the chaos in your life? Your primary aim is a statement. What you wish your life to look like when it's finally done. It's a communication to yourself that you take your life seriously. It's a communication to yourself that you come face to face with your own mortality. It's the absolutely essential step for anyone who's to become a manager of anything, of anyone who's going to become an entrepreneur of anything, of anyone who's going to become the father of anyone, of anyone who's going to become the mother of anyone, or the sister, or the brother, or in relationship with anyone. Because if I don't know who I am, I cannot relate to anyone in any way other than by accident in reaction to who I believe they are. Krishnamurti once said, we don't know anyone. All we have are pictures of people who we believe to be them, but aren't them at all. Our pictures are interacting with their pictures, and our pictures are as false as their pictures are. Who am I? Who do I wish to be? My primary aim